$1 million. I'm sure there are several or many millionaires in this congregation, either with cash in their pockets or at least that much debt. What would you do with $1 million? What would you do with $1 million? When a farmer in Minnesota, while I was growing up, won a lottery and got a $1 million check, which at that time was a lot of money, reporters immediately asked him what he'd do with it. And he was honest. He said, "I'll probably keep farming till it's gone." $1 million. $10 million. Let's up the ante. $10 million. What would you do for $10 million? You know, we have the possibility of knowing what some of us would do for $10 million. You've probably read at least one, if not a dozen or 300 books by James Patterson. He's written a few, co-authored many others with many people. You've read them. They're fast reads. They're exciting. Some years ago, he partnered with someone to look at research done by a major polling firm in the U.S., and they asked that very question, what would you do for $10 million? And it was kind of illuminating. The book they wrote about it is called The Day America Told the Truth. And for $10 million, 3% of us would kill a stranger. For $10 million, 6% of us would lie on the witness stand to put someone in jail or to get someone off who was known to have killed someone. We would lie on a witness stand, 6% of us. 10% of us would give up a child for adoption. 10% of us are thinking, which one? Twenty-3% of us would leave our spouse for no reason other than to get $10 million. 17% of us would work as a prostitute for a week or longer for $10 million. Fully 25% of us, 1 in 4, half of one of these halves, would walk away from our families for $10 million. Who are you? What will you do if the price is right? This is part of what James is looking at every passage in this letter. We started last week, James, of course, the younger brother of Jesus, the leader of the church, the early Christian church, headquartered in Jerusalem, the guy they used to vote as the president of the first synod of the Christian Reformed Church, Acts 15. The guy who sent the word out to the churches that Gentiles don't have to become Jews in order to become Christians. And he sends this longer letter with that short letter to the churches scattered around the Mediterranean basin. Claudius is the emperor of Rome at this time. Remember Robert Graves' fascinating novels, I, Claudius, and Claudius the God? This is the one sort of moderate, bright light between Caligula and Nero. Caligula before and Nero next. The world is fairly stable. The Empire of Rome is still fairly new after the many centuries of the Republic. And the Christian church is expanding rapidly, especially not only among Jewish folk, but with Gentiles. Barnabas and Paul have gone on their first mission journey, and they've come back and told of the wonderful things that God is doing. And James, the one who will be martyred for his Christian faith, sends this letter out, and he wants to remind his fellow Jews, his fellow Jewish Christians, his fellow Gentile Christians, how to live appropriately in these changing times. We pick it up at chapter 1, verse 19 this morning. And if you have Bibles, you can read it on the screen certainly, but if you have Bibles, you'll notice that 19, 20, and 21 are kind of brought together as one paragraph, and then 22 through 25 are brought together as a second paragraph, and then 26 and 27 are brought together as sort of a third paragraph. If you studied English, you know that paragraphs try to give some sort of cohesive idea. And in fact, there are three cohesive ideas here among the many bits and pieces that James has. And I want you to think about these in this way. Think of them as in, out, and up, okay, for the three paragraphs. In, out, and up. Listen to what James tells us by the Spirit of Jesus. My dear brothers and sisters, take note of this. Everyone should be quick to listen, slow to speak, and slow to become angry. For a man's anger does not bring about the righteous life that God desires. Therefore, get rid of all moral filth and the evil that is so prevalent, and humbly accept the word planted in you, which can save you. Do not merely listen to the word and so deceive yourselves. Do what it says. If anyone listens to the word but does not do what it says, he's like a man who looks at his face in the mirror and after looking at himself goes away and immediately forgets what he looks like. But the man who looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues to do this, not forgetting what he has heard, but doing it, he will be blessed in what he does. If anyone considers himself religious and yet does not keep a tight rein on his tongue, he deceives himself and his religion is worthless. Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world. Looking in. James talks about anger. Anger as the expression of often what's wrong inside of us. Anger is the outward expression of pain, sometimes stifled, but pain. And pain comes to us in so many varieties, right? There's, of course, physical pain. When you get a paper cut, and oh, does it hurt. Or you're peeling vegetables, and the peeler slips and slices just into your skin a little bit. Or the pain that I experienced when I was much younger and my good friend bought a 10-speed bike. Out on the farm, we didn't have 10-speed bikes, but he had a 10-speed bike, and he bought it with his own money, and he allowed me to try it. And I took off on that thing and went so fast that I couldn't even see the stone that went in front of the wheel and upended me, and I skidded across the road. And I have a spot on this knee that to this day does not feel anything because of the intense pain that I felt that day. Or there's surgery. And we go through it. We're thankful. We're thankful for Dr. Alexander Simpson and ether and all kinds of knockout gases and other things they put into our system so we don't feel the pain. Physical pain. Physical pain is there. Ouch. But there's also mental pain when we aren't acknowledged for who we truly are, the brilliance of our lives. I often say to my students, back in 1936, oh, that's right. There wasn't a world in 1936 because you weren't here. The world begins with us, right? It is the only thing that matters. And emotional pain is when we're not recognized for the people we truly are. Bullied, put down, ignored. Someone else gets ahead of us. It's the way of life, and we feel the pain. There's social pain, of course, social pain. Remember when John F. Kennedy stood next to that growing wall in Berlin and said to the world by way of satellite transmission, first time done, "Ich bin ein Berliner"? And remember how Ronald Reagan stood next to that wall and said, "Mr. Gorbachev, tear down that wall." And now every person in the world, except for Vladimir Putin and his colleagues, are Ukrainians. We feel the pain. We feel the anguish. We feel the distress of a community watching a child, a young girl in yellow, not knowing who's going to look after her. The rumbling of the tanks through the streets and the destruction of a society for what? And we feel that social pain. There's psychological pain, a fourth kind of pain, psychological pain that is inflicted from one on another, particularly in close relationships where brutality and mind-bending words can make a person feel as if she is nothing, where the brutality doesn't erupt in physical attacks, but day after day after day drives one down until they feel as if they are nothing and there's no way of escape. I stood in a home in another city while I was pastor in a church. I'd been asked by the wife in a couple that I had recently officiated at their marriage. And everything was wonderful, and everything was beautiful, and everything was perfect. And I watched as that young husband took away car keys, phone, wallet, and even took out a hammer and nailed windows shut. He was going to make sure that his wife, that he was treating badly, would have no escape. I felt powerless at the time. I called the authorities and I called her family living an hour's drive away. She was rescued, but how many times doesn't that psychological warfare destroy the psyches of children and of partners in marriage and of others? And then there's the pain of a loss of meaning. Simon Wiesenthal helped us understand that a bit. Maybe you've read his book, Sunflower. He was a Jew, taken to a camp. He survived. Who knows why? But during his days in the camp, he was summoned by one of the guards and taken through several corridors and up a flight of stairs into a back room that was dark, and he could smell death in the room. There was a German officer on a bed there. He'd been injured, and it was obvious that he was not going to recover from his wounds. And the German officer said to him, "I've done some bad things in my life," and went on with a litany of some of the things that he most recently had done in rounding up the Jews from a particular village, putting them all in a building at the center of the village, nailing shut the doors and windows, putting gasoline around the building, then setting his troops there with their guns and lighting the place on fire. And they had free rein to do whatever they wanted with any who tried to drop down from second-story windows and run away. But now he was dying. Now he was dying. What was he likely to see on the other side? After all, he came from a good Lutheran family. And he knew there was an afterlife. And he needed to confess, and he needed to confess to someone who was Jewish. And so there was Simon Wiesenthal. Bring him in. You have to hear my story, and then you have to forgive me. Forgive you? Forgive you? Simon Wiesenthal, for the rest of his life, was plagued and tortured by that. What does it mean to forgive someone who has done something so atrocious, so nasty, so horrible? Is there forgiveness? He writes his book, Silence, telling the story and sending it out to people of all religious faiths, to leaders, to ethicists, asking them, what would you do? What would you do? And the reviews come back mixed. Can you, in that spot, forgive? Forgive. We're robbed of meaning when words no longer matter and deeds are so askew from what is right. And there's deep, deep pain. Deep pain. And that's when anger comes. Anger erupts. James talks about anger. Anger comes because we no longer have a resolution to what is good and right. Our bodies hurt. Our minds are tossed. Our society is ripped, and there's anger. Look inward, says James. Look inward to understand yourself. And then he looks outward on doing after we've looked closely in the mirror to see ourselves. Do we know what's going on? Can we act appropriately? Do we live in confluence with our faith, our understanding, our worldview? Do we live in that way? James talks about living consistently with what is true inside to becoming people of significance on the outside. There's a town in England that used to tell the story of its existence, its formation. It was on the west coast where the waves pounded against the rocks and the shore. And many ships, earlier times, foundered there, were ripped apart on the rocks. Many people died. And eventually a community developed there. Often those who had survived shipwreck, many more did not. They constituted a community of survivors, and they thought that they should do something about this treacherous and terrible strip of shore. And they decided that they would develop what they called the Signal Fire Brigade. And so every day they would scrounge the woods for pieces of wood. They would gather these together. They would create stacks of firewood, and every night they would light the fire. When it was calm, when the skies were clear, when the moon and the stars were out, it was not that bad. But there were other days when it was stormy and wet and windy, and you couldn't get the fire to light, and you had to because of the ships out at sea. But they did this. Day after day they did this, and everybody in town took part in it. When they found that it was possible to keep the light burning longer with kerosene, they created the lighthouse, and they put up a tall structure with a kerosene lamp at the top. They magnified it with lenses till it shone far out to sea, and they were able to bring some warning to ships that were passing by. And over the years, in order to protect those who were manning the kerosene lantern, they created a small building down below, a place where they would allow people to stay at night and their families could come and they could get food and rest and shelter. And after a while, when electricity came through, they put in a wonderful, brilliant lamp, electric lamp, showing far out to sea. And what had once been the rescue brigade and the signal fire brigade and the lighthouse brigade turned into the lighthouse social club. It was the thing to be part of. the wealthy in particular paid for those less fortunate than them to do the work while they took care of business below, mainly enjoying wonderful feasts that were now catered in by others who were paid. The Christmas ball every year was the greatest event in town, and people dressed to the nines for the opportunity to be seen and to see others and to rub shoulders with the wealthy and the powerful. And on one of those Christmas Eve ball occasions, as they were dancing down below, for some reason the light went out above. And while the band played on, another ship foundered on the rocks and lives were destroyed. That image becomes too often an image of those who look in the mirror in the morning and by evening don't remember themselves. They've checked out what's inside of pain, trying to deal with it, but by evening, I'm the one who's in charge of my world and I will do what I want. Or communities and even churches that live as if we have it all together. And being here is the best thing that ever happened to us. Sometimes when I'm working with congregations and we're making plans for next stages in ministry development, they toss out a variety of possibilities. I suggest, you know, throw it all out there. Let's start sorting through it. But there's one thing they never consider until I bring it up. What if you would lock the doors of the church on Sundays before the congregation gathers? Then what would the church be? What if the church was more than Sunday gatherings? Oh, we know it's true. We know it's true. And this is a good church doing many things. We heard that last week. But what if sometimes we are blinded by our lack of ability to see till all we think about is Sunday mornings and the identity of faith is gone? This is the kind of thing that James asks us about. Look in, look out. And then he says some things that I want to meet the man someday. I expect to meet the man someday. But he says some things with regard to what my religion is and could be and ought to be about. To care for the orphan and the widow. Now, we have so many services in our world to care for those who are without other resources, separated from families. But in James' world, apart from family, you didn't have anything. You were truly without any possible self-support. And the orphan and the widow, from the earliest of the biblical texts, are those that God identifies as most embodying the ones that God is concerned about. Our oldest daughter is teaching at Villanova University in Philadelphia. And the last time we went to see her, their house is very small with four of them, and we stayed at a hotel not that far away. As we were driving to the hotel, there were signs for a number of places to go. One was Villanova University, but another was Eastern University. Eastern University. I've never been there. But I've heard of a famous person who used to teach at Eastern University. Eastern Christian College at that time. He was the head of the sociology department. His name was Anthony Campolo, Tony Campolo. And he remembered going to Hawaii to speak at a conference, poor guy. They had asked him to come all the way from Philadelphia to Hawaii to speak at a conference. And he was put up at a hotel in Honolulu. And while the plane was a long flight, it allowed him to get there fairly quickly. So his body was still on Eastern time while his surroundings were on Pacific and beyond Hawaiian time. He fell asleep quickly that night, almost mid-afternoon local time, but it wasn't far after midnight when he was up and alert and his stomach said, "You need to feed me." And so he started looking for a restaurant where he could get an early morning breakfast. There was nothing open at the hotel and nothing in surrounding blocks of the city. He wandered for a bit. It was so nice to be out in this marvelous air of Hawaii. Finally, as he went down one street, he saw up an alley some dingy pane glasses there, windows, where the light was shining through, and this sign had most of the letters lit, O-P-E-N. And so he went there and did find a diner that stayed open all night. He went through the doors and immediately realized that this was probably not the best of places to go because his feet started sticking as he walked across the linoleum that had not been cleaned since Pearl Harbor. But it was the only place that was open, and he was here now, so he walked up to the counter, sat down in one of those swivel chairs that had still some red on it. The rest had been torn off over the years. He put his hands on, or his elbows on the counter, and they didn't move. He looked at the menu and thought, "I better not open that. There might be something in there that crawls out with too many legs that I can't count." The guy behind the counter was named Joe, and Tony knew this because he was wearing an apron, and although it was very greasy, he could still see the embroidering Joe. And Joe said to him, "What are you going to have?" And Tony said, "How about a cup of coffee and a donut?" "Sure, coming right up." So he went over to the coffee urn, and he took a fairly clean cup, and he cut off a piece of yesterday's whatever, sloshed it on the counter in front of Tony, and then went over to a cracked plastic cover on a raised stand, took his right hand and wiped it across his dirty apron and used that to lift the plastic, and with his other hand he took a donut and put that down on the counter in front of Tony. It was not fresh. Tony began to eat this and drink a little bit and get out of there as quickly as he could with perhaps a little bit more in his stomach when all at once, bam, the doors banged open behind him. And in walked over a dozen women, mostly quite young. And they came in and they surrounded Tony at the counter so that he couldn't possibly leave. There he was, trapped at the counter. And the women were talking, even right across Tony. The one on his right said, "Hey, what day is this?" And someone else yelled out a day. And she said, "Huh, it's my birthday tomorrow." And the one on his left said, "Well, what do you want, a birthday cake?" "No," she said, "it's just that I've never had anybody celebrate my birthday with. I was just saying. And they talked on, and about as quickly as they arrived and got stuff from Joe at the counter, they were gone again. And Tony said to Joe, "Whoa, that was interesting." "Oh, yeah," he says, "that's why we stay up all night. They come in every night when they're done with their work." And you know what work they were doing. "Say," says Tony to Joe, the gal standing next to me, "yeah, that's Agnes. That's Agnes. She comes in here every morning." He said, "Agnes was saying that it's her birthday tomorrow, and I was just wondering, what do you think, you and me throw her a birthday party?" Joe looks back toward that little hole that goes to the grill behind the counter. He yells to his wife, who's back there, Hey, did you hear that? Agnes has a birthday tomorrow, and this guy wants to throw a birthday party for it. Wants to know if you want to do it here. She yells something back, and Joe says, hey, let's do it. Let's have a party. He says that his wife will put the word out on the street, and by 3 o'clock the next morning, they're going to all be there, and Tony's going to bring some things. Tony says, I'll bring a cake. No, you don't, says Joe. This is my place, and I do the cooking here, and if it's going to be a cake, it's going to be one of my cakes. Okay. By 3 o'clock the next morning, Tony was back at the place, and some of the dust had been moved. There were even some plastic flowers on some of the tables, and Tony hung up that streamer that goes, Happy Birthday. And Joe was so proud. Joe was so proud of what he had made. He had made a birthday cake, and it was beautiful. It was frosted. It had candles on it. It even had words, Happy Birthday, Agnes, and all of them were spelled right. He was ready, and the people started pouring in. Word had gone out on the street, free eats, and by 3:15, the place was packed, and at 3:30, when the women slammed their way in, it was wall-to-wall people, and no one could even find a place to sit anymore. As soon as they moved in, Tony was ready. Come on, folks, let's sing together. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Agnes. Happy birthday. And of course, they harmonized to every octave on that last note. Agnes was dumbfounded. She stood there, couldn't believe what was going on. She couldn't move. Joe was embarrassed by her not moving. Hey, Agnes, come on up here. Look what I made for you. And the crowd parted enough that she could see the cake on the counter. Come on, Agnes, he said. Let's cut the cake. Blow out these candles so we can cut the cake and we can all have a piece. And Agnes was just crying. She couldn't move. Come on, Agnes, he said. We're all getting hungry. Finally, Agnes began to move through the crowd up to the counter. But she didn't blow out the candles. And now Joe was really nervous. Come on, Agnes, blow out the candles and we can get to have something to eat. And finally, Agnes, between the sobs and the tears, she didn't even look up at Joe, but she said, No one's ever made me a birthday cake before. She said, could I maybe just take it and show my mom? Now Joe is dumbfounded. He says, I don't know. It was his idea, pointing to Tony. You'll have to ask him. Tony said, Agnes, it's your birthday. It's your cake. You do with it whatever you want. And Agnes picked up that cake like it was the Holy Grail itself. And she turned around, and there was dead silence in the room. As she stepped ahead and the people parted like water until she reached the door and she was gone. And Joe didn't know what to do, but Tony did. He grabbed one of those chairs that someone had stood up from. He put it down in the middle of that open space. He stood up on that and he said, let's pray. And he offered a prayer for Agnes and for her mother and for her life and for that she would come to know the great love God had for her and for all who with her shared the work that she did and how they would come to find themselves along the way and for everybody in this place that they would know what it meant to be loved by God. And when he said amen, Joe leaned across that counter and he wagged a finger at him and said, you didn't tell me you was a preacher. Then he got this sly smile on his face. And he said, "What kind of church are you a preacher at anyway?" And Tony said, "I'm a preacher at a church that throws birthday parties for prostitutes at 3:30 in the morning." Joe had to think about that for a minute. And then he got a big grin and he said, "Nah, you almost had me there. If there was a church like that, I'd be a member." Religion that God our Father accepts as pure and faultless is this: to look after orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself from being polluted by the world, which doesn't live by those values. Pray with me. Jesus, we ask that you will purify our hearts. We've done that already, but we do it again. Because the contaminations, the pandemic virus of sin spread across our world, makes us sick so easily. Keeps us from seeing ourselves truly, and allows the little and great angers within to erupt in bad ways. On this day and in this place, we ask you, give us your grace, your mercy, and your peace to know again what it is that true religion is all about, and then to live as if that mattered. In your name we ask it.